Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Midrack, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things Marine. And welcome everybody to the March 8th edition of Midrats. We have a melee with our usual panel. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and we have with us today coming back in full force, Galarin from Information Dissemination, and of course, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We might have an extra special guest later on in the show, if we can make the ones and the zeros. I'll introduce him when he comes on board, but if we get him on board today, really no introduction will be needed for him, and if we miss it, then we'll bring him back. But what we're going to do today is what we do on our melee sessions. Is we are going to talk about the major issues if we see them for the day. If you would like to contribute, we already have the usual suspects up on the chat room on the Midrats show page. I know a couple of people trouble finding it in the past, but if you go to the show page for this specific episode near the bottom of the page, you will see the chat, so you can come on board. Eagle One, as Law of the Sea, he is right and heard on the chat room, so if you have some things you want to bring up, come on into the chat room and let us know what they are. What I wanted to start with today, this is not the Navy Pirate Show, though our regular listeners I know have heard us do two dedicated shows on piracy, but this is the in the season in which you're going to see a lot more piracy. And the pirates are not in my brain. It is March 7th. My apologies. But if you've been following the news, I want to quote something from an article that came out early last week to show how things have subtly changed. And though I'm mentioning nations here, these are that are members of larger organizations. So when you see NATO or you see EU, these organizations all run on consensus. And in order to activate a certain ROE line number, you have agreement by all member states. So you're always running by the lowest common denominator. And that's what can be very frustrating sometimes when you're working in these organizations, is that they don't move real fast. But when they move, it's important to take note of. So from the AP, Somali pirate security personnel in four shootouts. Fought him with Commander John Harbour from the European Union Naval Force. He stated, quote, "We know the month is over. We know they're coming," Harbour said. "We're taking the fight to the pirates." The most serious skirmish Friday, six pirates attacked the vessel before breaking off and chasing the fishing boat Torre Julia, Harbour said. Two other French fishing vessels nearby, the unpronounceable and the even more unpronounceable, aided the Torre Grilla. Military detachment aboard one vessel fired warning shots at the pirates but failed to stop the attack. They later approached the skiff and collided with it, that is the fishing boat, said Harbour, sinking the skiff and throwing the pirates in the water. Four were rescued and the aircraft was searching for the other two. In a second incident, an EU naval force intercepted a pirate group of one mothership and two skiffs that it attacked a separate French vessel. That attack was also repelled by military personnel on board. The EU Naval Force helicopter tracked the pirates and watched them throw a rocket with grappling hooks and fuel barrels in the ocean. The force said it then destroyed the mothership in one skiff while taking 11 pirates into custody. The third and fourth attacks assaulted two Spanish tuna fishing boats off the boat off the coast of Kenya. A spokesman spoke on condition of anonymity because the government rules don't allow him to be identified, but the clashes were confirmed by Deputy Private De La Vega. These incidents followed a firefight on Thursday between private security contractors on board a Spanish fishing vessel and pirates. The story goes on to describe those in detail. And then finally, the note from Commander Harbour, the quote, the EU NAVFOR agrees with the nation because we don't want an escalation of firepower. There are lots of gas and oil tankers in the Gulf of Aden that would benefit from, that would not benefit from grenades and bullets flying around. And he was responding to a comment about the armed security guard. We've actually had a guest of one of the people who run the companies on there. So piracy is expanding, and we also have the response expanding incrementally as well. Eagle One, if you could take a with me or piracy, Smee, if you could take a moment to talk about what makes this type of year so special and some of the other developments we've seen this week in the response to piracy.
Okay. The winds have died down in the Gulf of Aden. They're also lessening in the Indian Ocean as the winter monsoon ends. And this creates better piracy conditions. I think if you look at some of the photographs that have recently come out about some of the pirate attacks and the activities of the Navy's involved in dealing with the pirates, you'll see that it's much calmer out there than it has been during the winter months. The EU announced this new, I'm going to call it a blockade, but they're really much more active in interdicting the pirates from the pirates' ports back in the end of February. And we're just seeing now that come into fruition. In addition to the EU efforts, we do have CTF-151, and more particularly the Turks in the last couple of days have captured, I don't know, 14 pirates, including a couple that they just captured today. And I see that Saturn V is online at his blog, Bosphorus. He had some pictures of the takedown by the Turks by the Turkish frigate Gemlik, which I think is a former U.S. FIG. So where everybody's getting much more active. They're taking down the pirates on their boats. They're sinking the boats, and that can only mean good things for the anti-pirate forces. You know, of course, now the pirates also have expanded their efforts to capturing ship off Madagascar. And so it remains a very active front and one that we need to fight.
Galran.
Well, there's a couple of things to note here. This is the second year of the European Union Task Force. This is really the second and a half year of NATO out there, and this is the second year of Task Force 151. So we've gone through a year of lessons learned and tactics developed and understanding the monitoring their operations and understanding the way that the pirates are conducting themselves. We've probably mapped out and charted what their ports are, and all we're seeing is a tactical evolution, and this is what you would expect when you come off your first year and it was a bad year. To date, it hasn't been heavily active, but the pirates have had some success. Even through the winter months, they were able to get some successes. The real key here is that the weather is dying down, and things are about to get active throughout those seas. We still have the corridor set up and established that has been largely successful. Despite the large number of attacks, the rate of successful hijackings was down last year. There are currently six ships that are being held by the Somali pirates after the release of the Thai ship, either today or yesterday. I'm not really sure when it was released exactly. But there's a lot coming together. China's deployed a new task force. So you can see how everything is kind of working together. There are still several questions. One, is China going to step up and take control of the working group? I think a lot of people would be very encouraged if that took place. That is a major seminal event in the fight against piracy, because it would suggest that, you know, we're going to see an active China in the Indian Ocean, and I think that a lot of countries are not just resigned to that possibility, but would be encouraged by it, which is a different way of looking at it than it was, you know, when they first started their deployments. The second thing is that we're seeing the EU, and this isn't NATO, this is EU, the European Union, stepping up their procedures. That's noteworthy because what it does is you look at the EU right now and they're having all kinds, it's actually an organization that was developed regarding finances and economics, and here they are, you know, pushing the security rules of engagement a little bit further. They're trying to build some longevity into it, into their institution, just at a time where the institution is being questioned due to, you know, matters of economics related to Greece. So there's a lot of things that are happening, and piracy seems to be one of those tie-ins where you have a lot of international partners coming together. We have not seen a rules of engagement change by the United States. With the Dutch and the French and the Spanish all fishing that area, it's interesting that you're seeing the Europeans are the ones that are stepping up. That's new. When was the last time the Europeans led anything with regards to military affairs? So there's a lot to watch here.
Absolutely. I think when you mention activity, whether people welcome it or not, it's going to happen. Something that kind of slipped under everybody's radar, I'm going to have a quick post on it Monday or Tuesday, is people have gotten the vapors over the years over the fact that the Chinese are so involved nowadays at the Panama Canal. Well, over at the southern reaches of the Suez Canal, the Chinese, in conjunction with the Egyptian government, are putting forward a rather significant economic effort. So they will not have that larger sea line of communications concern that any nation that's growing like they are reliant on maritime trade would have. But in the approaches to the Suez, they're going to have an additional economic input, which, knowing the way the Chinese do business, means that the government officials in Egypt and the government officials in China are really going to be working a lot more intimately than they had in the past. Eagle One, over to you.
Yeah, I can't find it right now, but there was a reference in a recent article I saw that we're trying to do a swarm attack on a merchant ship, and the rules of engagement that either NATO or EU had was that they none of those ships could fire on the pirates until they actually attacked the ship. But apparently a Chinese warship showed up and looked like it was weapons free, and the pirates called off their attack. So as soon as I can track that down, it's a pretty good indication that Chinese have come to play seriously in the pirate role.
Gallagher?
Yeah. Another thing to watch as the weather is changing is we started the year, and I posted on this pretty heavily in January with Al Qaeda in Yemen, or Al Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, threatening areas of the sea to the south of the Arabian Peninsula, which would be mostly the Gulf of Aden, but you have to imagine that it's also going to be the Red Sea. And as the weather improves, that has the potential to become a factor to watch for. Just because the focus has been piracy, the Canadians are there as part of the anti-terrorism role, and there are other nations that are there as part of anti-terrorism, and that has the real potential to become something. I mean, this is going to be more of an attack against ships as opposed to just the capturing of ships. And that changes the way you look at everything. Only 8 people died in 2009, which is a very low number. I mean, you can find 8 sailors who died in the Navy in operations, without much trouble. It's a little different when you say, well, 8 commercial mariners died due to piracy. That's not a lot, but 217 were injured, so that is a lot. It changes dramatically when you start adding the factor that if Al Qaeda strikes, and that I think that risk is very, very high now with the weather subsiding. There's no reason that they would try it in bad weather. There's every reason to believe that they would try it now that the weather is getting better. That has a real potential to put piracy back up on the front page of newspapers, or at least the activities at sea. And I'm not sure that the U.S. is positioned to adjust our tactics based on that rules of engagement change, only because if we start getting real violent, we have the potential for backlash, and that would lead into, you know, here come the coin theorists to discuss naval tactics, and that'll be interesting.
Yeah, if I could pimp our show a bit, back on the 14th of February, when we did our second episode on piracy, when we had former Marine and Special Agent Kevin Doherty on board, he echoed something that he mentioned when I interviewed him for USNI blog back in the fall, that we're going to have this arms race at sea, and you need to be prepared for it. And the guy obviously knows this, because that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a few more RPGs, and we're seeing the Spanish of all types, amongst others, who are putting security on there. And that argument, as things heat up, so far we've been lucky that there hasn't been a major conflagration, so to speak, in that arms race. I'm for one of those pirates' gifts to have a 23-millimeter on the back of it, and we'll see what happens with that. But I think you're right. That's definitely a concern going forward. Eagle One.
Yeah, the other thing should be noticed is the pirates apparently, or people who are pirate likes, and there's obviously not piracy, but they've taken to attacking the UN World Food Program truck in Somalia, too, as another way to generate revenue for themselves. And I'm not sure how much that is a reflection of a decline in their piracy over a period of time, or whether they're just attempting to branch out into different forms of thuggery.
Eagle One, did you have another topic you wanted to address today?
Well, I would like to commend whoever was responsible for catching the American traitor Adam,
Adam
I guess is. Yeah, Adam Gadon. Whoever did that, bless them, and I can't wait to see where we're going to have our first treason trial in Lord knows how many hundreds of years, but this could be really interesting.
Yeah, I saw that on Drudge right before I came on here. Hey, varsity football for the Attorney General. Given some of the decisions made recently, it would be very curious to see what direction we go to. But you brought up a very good point. I think it would be very difficult not to define that man is done as treason, as an American citizen, and everything that goes with it for what he's been involved with. Gowron, I know you've been on the road for a while. I don't know whether you've caught that, but do you have some thoughts on that development?
Well, a little bit. You know, it ties into something that's been on my mind for a couple of weeks. You know, I get a lot of news from New York City because I live upstate New York, and that's the mecca here. Albany is the mecca of government, but New York City is the mecca of commerce. And nobody wanted the trial. And, you know, DHS and Justice, these agencies are being run by morons, in my opinion. It just makes no sense at all that you would spend $200 million to hold a trial for some asshole who's responsible for terrorism in New York City, of all places, when you might as well just hold that trial in Idaho and get it away from people, or Guantanamo Bay or whatever. It doesn't matter where they end up holding these trials, but the idea that you want to spend that much money to hold it in a city like New York City is just ridiculous. And I kept thinking about how this administration seems to be willing to spend huge amounts of money in order to promote their justice system for dealing with terrorism, and yet, you know, the Coast Guard is struggling for money just to put enough ships to sea. And the relative cost, I mean, $200 million in the Coast Guard is a lot different than $200 million in the Navy. You can build some cutters. And it just ticks me off a little bit where the priorities are. It was just that contradiction between where we would put our money for the justice system as opposed to our police system, and I was thinking specifically for the Coast Guard, is ridiculous.
If I was going to place my vote on where to put Mr. Gadon, you can put him in L.A., Lower Alabama. It's a pretty low cost of living there, and I'm sure the jury pool would probably meet the requirements for both most Americans, at least. Eagle One.
Yeah, I think the other, other than Adam Canaan, whatever his name is, the soon-to-be martyr, I hope, one of the big news things was the speech that Admiral Mullen gave at University of Kansas. And some people are hailing it as the new Mullen Doctrine replacing the Powell Doctrine. I noticed that Brian McGrath on Galran's site had a little piece on it. And, you know, his take was, sort of like the one after I read it, that not much has changed. In fact, it's a little doubtful why we're calling that a new doctrine. But basically, the Admiral says we need a forward presence to deter things, that the U.S. military should not be the last option in matters of efforts, and we should increase power. I'm not sure how that differs from the some of that stuff differs from what's in the Navy maritime strategy that came out recently, but he laid it out in a speech, and some people seem to be taking it very seriously.
Galran?
I'm to the point where it drives me crazy that we see people like Gates and Mullen give a speech and people put significance behind it. I can't remember doctrine being developed due to a speech. I always thought that doctrine was developed by strategy, and it just annoys me that we put speeches and we promote them to such an important elevate them to such an important level of significance and influence over our military affairs, when in fact that's not how it's done. You know, it can be a great speech, and it can say all the right things, and it can be significant, but to replace the Powell Doctrine with a speech, give me a break. That just drives me nuts. We have to get back to actually developing plans and thinking about things from a strategy, policy strategy, you know, tactics, doctrine, operations. The process by which things are developed is messed up when you add speech to this process. What is going on? In my opinion, the Mullen speech is a very interesting speech in that it says three things. One, it says that Mullen is basically on board with Gates into institutionalizing counterinsurgency doctrine and this theory of joint interrelational, international relations approach to foreign policy. Yeah, gotcha. The Coalition of the Willing was one of the largest coalitions ever, and yet we call that a failure. I mean, you know, some of this is just bullshit.
I'll echo your bullshit columns. You're exactly right of what drives strategy. And I keep most of my thoughts, though not all of them, I keep them on my home blog when I do decide to make a comment about it. But Admiral Mullen's desire to interject himself in some way and make it about himself is highly unfortunate. And I also find it highly unfortunate that people are taking his speech when you're talking about forward presence, not being a last option, all that. I mean, exactly like you said, this is nothing new. This is nothing shocking. And the U.S. Navy or the military in general, because they're the Joint Chiefs, is not going to pivot based on a speech. I think what that does is it adds more confusion to a topic more than anything else. If we have a maritime strategy, that's our maritime strategy, and let's talk about that. Let's don't have leadership by public speech. That not only confuses those in uniform, it confuses the decision makers, it confuses the taxpayer, and it really muddies the water a lot.
You know, just to beat the dead horse maybe a little bit, but here's a quote from the Mullen speech. He says, President Obama noted in his West Point speech when he announced strategy for Afghanistan, we cannot count on military might alone. Well, you know, I seem to remember some other president, I think his initials were TR, who said something like, speak softly and carry a big stick. I mean, I don't understand why these seem like, you know, are we rediscovering our history, and because nobody knows history. I mean, it just makes no sense to me, and very frustrating.
Gallagher.
No, I agree completely with Eagle One's assessment. This is not, I mean, I'm not even sure that Mullen didn't really try to replace the Powell Doctrine. I think a lot of people took it as a way to try to discard the Powell Doctrine. And the distinction is important because we have to give Mullen the benefit of the doubt there. What he's really doing is he's emphasizing that the United States is moving through a period of tough economic times, our military is downsizing, and we're going to need a greater level of support internationally in order to achieve our foreign policy and national objectives. That makes a lot of sense. That's what the maritime strategy said. That's what I expect the national defense strategy to say. That a speech is some sort of pivot point is kind of a joke, because I think the pivot point should be highlighted and acclaimed as the maritime strategy, because it was the pivot point. And nobody wants to give it any credit. And the Navy seems to just sit on their hands on taking credit, because they don't even really believe their own maritime strategy themselves based on their own budgets. So, you know, it's funny how the way that everybody in Washington that's not in the Navy is ready to accept what the Navy has developed in their maritime strategy as a pivot position towards this is what our national strategy policy and policies should be developed towards in terms of a direction. And yet the Navy themselves doesn't seem interested in that perspective, because they are too busy developing their own way of war in the 21st century, and they're having trouble matching the words to their actions. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's just the way that I see it. Mullen is not saying anything new. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people who think that it's an important speech. These are very credible people, and I give them the benefit of the doubt that it's a very important speech. But I'm with Brian McGrath. What makes it so important besides the New York Times covered it? Is there some specific point within the speech that people can highlight and say, wow, that is really, you know, enlightening? And I'm not sure that it's there, because everything that was said has been said before recently, and I thought we were not supposed to be institutionalizing the current wars for future conflicts, and that's exactly what the framework is here. I got one email, I think it was from Claude Berube, who pointed out, you know, this looks almost like it was developed for a CNAS, by CNAS. And you know what? It very easily could have been, because that was the tone and tenor of what came out in terms of what was emphasized and what was covered in the media regarding the speech.
Yeah, you know my opinion of CNAS and a variety of things that they do, but there's some good-meaning folks over there. But you're right about the tone. And this here we have with one of the perils of going without a net on live radio, our special, believe I have on hold. Let me see if I can bring him up here. And if this is a caller that has a question, then we'll deal with that as well. Norman, is this
yes.
You on area code 917?
As far as I can tell, yes.
Outstanding. Just
thank
like to introduce everybody to my readers. He really needs no introduction. This is the line, Norman Friedman. If you read anything involving ships, strategy, the direction of our Navy, and where we need to be going, you should know Norman Friedman. Welcome to Midrest, Norman.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And thanks for coming and filling the gaps. And what we'll do is, I think you've been listening to this, been a whole. Let's just go ahead and pivot here, because one thing that Galler and I really enjoyed in our discussions with you in San Diego last month, and also a lot of the material that you've written and the panels you've been on, is subject of what kind of Navy we need to have. What type of Navy do we need to be focused on in order to move forward here beyond 2010 as the rest of the world revolves around us? So if you could, just to get things kicked off, Norman, tell us where you see we are here in 2010 and where you see there's a gap in the Navy that we're trying to develop that we need to perhaps focus a little more attention and a little more intellectual rigor to.
Well, let's go back to what I heard of the last few speakers. The Navy publishes a strategy talking about how it has to work with many other navies. And in fact, if you have a sort of dispersed global problem, any very expensive navy will find it hard to be in many places at once. And then the question is, do you turn into a navy of less expensive ships in very large numbers, if you could possibly manage that, which is a question, or is there some way in which you can encourage other governments who benefit from the sea and who have somewhat similar requirements to somehow get together with us? That's a very hard thing to do. I've been working on British naval history, which turns out to be very much like ours. And their problem always was that the Commonwealth governments clearly had the same interest in protecting the sea as the British government. However, the question then was, how did you make them contribute? Or rather, how did you convince them to contribute? Because, like us, the British didn't control those places, even though we may imagine they did. The people running places like Australia and Canada could decide whether or not to pay up. So how do you convince them that it's worth the trouble? Or how do you convince them that they ought to pay more than the absolute minimum when you're willing to pay a great deal because it's in your interest? And we've been talking a lot about building larger numbers of smaller ships, which are these little combat ships. The question really to me is what we contribute to the pot that the other countries can't contribute, in return for which we can convince them to contribute more of their local forces. Okay? Hello?
Yep.
Am I on?
So what you're looking at is kind of that, I can't stand the phrase, but kind of leveraging the concept behind the Global Maritime Partnership, because there's certain things that we can, that our allies, either due to economics or the scale of their shipbuilding programs or their ability to sustain, really can't fill, but they can bring in those gaps, kind of like in the Cold War with what we did with mine warfare and things in that area.
Well, what you'd get out of that actually would be more emphasis on larger ships and on ocean surveillance rather than a very large program of smaller ships. You'd have some smaller ones because for some operations it would matter a lot that we could go in whether or not we had friends. But the question would then be whether, if we have these modular things that we plan to put on the LCS, whether they could perhaps be employed by some other kind of ship.
Gellerin.
Pardon?
Well, Norm, I love the way that you put that together. The question is, where are we seeing this partnership develop, in your opinion? I mean, is Japan in on this? Is South Korea bought in? Is Australia bought in?
Those countries have been allied for a long time. And they're also spending serious money on their navies.
Right.
That's the issue. The actual issue is going to be a partnership with countries that are not allies in Africa and in South America. And what we've tried to do in Africa anyway is to spread the idea that surveillance off their coast is in their own interest, and obviously we can provide some of the technology and the expertise to make that work. My guess is that's more valuable than showing up with naval forces, which they may regard as pressure. The Coast Guard is probably a more effective means than the Navy of showing up in a friendly but persuasive manner. And
yeah, that was
the Coast Guard building program is kind of important on a national level.
Yeah, that was my question. Is this what deep water should be leveraged in at the top end of deep water?
Deep water isn't designed for any of this stuff. Deep water is designed for a combination of ocean surveillance and executing drug interdiction and interdiction of people trying to get to the United States with explosives. But Coast Guards in general seem to be less aggressive to other governments than navies. So if you show up in a big Coast Guard cutter, you're regarded as a friend giving useful advice. If you show up in a battle group, you may be giving even better advice, but there'll be a larger segment of the local population and government that may be very nervous. We need the strike capability because nobody else can provide it. If you look around, there aren't a lot of aircraft carriers in the world that are any good. And I think that if strike becomes more and more important, the carrier capability matters more. If you marry the carrier capability with unmanned vehicles, it gets even more interesting. In fact, the price of strikes goes way down, but your ability to conduct sustained operations goes up. Also, if a lot of the current war involves headhunting, in effect, then these things seem to be a very good way of doing it. And they ought to come off the sea because eventually people will kick us out of land bases. That's a very common theme in naval warfare.
Dr. Freeman, let me. It sounds to me like you are kind of in parallel with Captain Hughes in his, I think it's the new Navy concept of a lot of smaller.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No, I'm not. Not at all.
And I'm prepared to be corrected.
Oh, no. Captain Hughes likes smaller ships, and I don't. They can't be deployed easily anywhere. They can't be sustained abroad. And they duplicate local capabilities. What's so terrific about them?
So what do you think about the midway approach the Navy is taking, where they don't take a strike package so much, they use the amphibious ships, and then they engage in their more of a soft power training activities as opposed to the hard power or even the Coast Guard approach?
The way that the soft power is really the Coast Guard approach. It's saying we can provide you with expertise that you really can use. We'll show up, we'll help train you. The big amphibs are well adapted to that because they have lots of space on board. And it's not a midway approach in the sense that from the building point of view, you wouldn't get rid of the big end. The high end to me is very valuable. It's what we uniquely provide, or it's rather one of several things we uniquely provide. The other unique thing is we do global ocean surveillance. Nobody else does. The only way you can operate sea control with limited numbers of ships is backed up by ocean surveillance. Other people do it on a limited scale, but nothing like what we do, and the technology and expertise we have is probably extremely valuable. It's something we can trade for their assistance, in effect. Duplicating those smaller ship navies is just wasting time.
A question here, when you mentioned earlier about the, by the way, this is Sal again. The question I had for you is, you mentioned earlier about some of the possibilities of partnering with our South American friends. With UNITAS, we've been doing this forever.
Sure.
But when you look south of the Panama Canal, two nations immediately come to mind. When you look at a nation that has gotten its footing, and we saw the work they did in peacekeeping and continue to do peacekeeping in Haiti, I'm talking about Brazil. They have a potential.
Yeah.
Everybody's talked about since World War II, the great potential of Brazil.
Right.
I think they might actually be getting some grip to go forward. But when you look at on the other side of the continent, I see Chile, who really has a strong economy. They're not as big as Brazil. Are there other nations besides Brazil and Chile that you would look at partners you'd really want to build a and what do you see that those two nations bring to the table?
Okay, first of all, you have two kinds of partners. You want to get friendlier with weak countries that need strengthening. If this current war is a war of subversion, which is the way it has always looked, then the people we're up against use weak countries to get a foothold. So it's very nice that Brazil and Chile are strong, powerful, healthy countries. What we worry about aren't them. They'll do fine. They're doing fine. They figured out what to do. You worry about places that aren't doing fine. You worry about what's happening between Colombia and Venezuela over the FARC guerrillas, for example. And the people that need backing are those who are more impoverished. Now, it may be that countries like Brazil and Chile will recognize that it's in their interest to achieve greater stability throughout the hemisphere, and they will help the countries that are having problems. You can't tell. But that's probably where we have to make the effort. And we have to do it without putting people's backs up, which is very difficult.
And you look, interesting you mentioned Colombia. It's one of my favorite nations down there, and it's not just their food. But I think that's one of the great undertold stories of the last decade or so, is the very successful partnering we have done, really all the services have, down in Colombia, especially when you look at their riverine forces. They've reached
points
that we actually can learn some things from Colombia about how to do riverine operations. You see, not so much as with the big guys, they're doing fine, but to focus on those that want to go in the right direction, whether politically and economically, but to help them on the sides to get strong and to reach that same level of strength that some of their larger neighbors have.
Oh, absolutely. That's the point. Look, the basis of the maritime strategy, and a lot of American policy really goes the same way, is the idea that if the world is more prosperous in general, a lot of the more horrible things that happen go away. People get nasty because they're broke. Actually, they get nasty for a lot of other reasons, but Americans tend to focus on that. And the idea is that those whose interest it is to make the world more stable or to become more dictatorial prefer a world which is in more economic trouble. And we would like to do our best in the Navy to maintain maritime trade, which has had a lot to do with making the world more prosperous. Now, you can make all sorts of arguments about other things like the economic side of things. When people talk about soft power, they're really two different kinds of lines that they're taking. One line is sort of, let's all be happy together. And that rightly makes a lot of people upset. Another line is that national power extends to financial things as well as to military. Very often the financial may actually be more powerful. And it's almost a call for the U.S. government to spend rather more effort on its strategy for how to support and mold the world economy. Now, the last couple of years haven't been too happy here that way, but in general, as the wealthiest country in the world, we have a good deal of power. And the question is how to use it or whether it can be used effectively. You want to reward those who are making things better where they are. That's
free
trade, things like that.
Yeah, I've been on the road for the better part of 3 weeks, and I'm going through books, and I'm currently reading the History of British Destroyers that you wrote. I love this book.
Thank you.
I bought it when I was out in San Diego when we met, and I had you sign it. It's fantastic. The question I have is, I'm looking at the Littoral Combat Ship. I'm looking at the FREM project that they're doing in Europe, and people are talking about the LCS being the next evolution of destroyers. The frigate of the 21st century is a phrase that we've seen Lockheed Martin executives use in proceedings. I just want to get your take on whether you see this as the evolution that people are saying that it will be, and is Bob Work right when he makes the claim, which is kind of a bold claim, that the whole world will be envious of us when we get this stuff to work?
Oh, dear. Well, you probably know that in print I haven't been exactly a fan.
Yeah, I'm aware.
The first thing about it is that I think the modular idea is really good. I think that the obsession with very high speed is really bananas. High speed, very high speed, usually turns out very unpleasantly for everybody. The French were real good at it between the wars. Afterwards, a French officer said he wished they'd never thought about it. High speed makes for drinking fuel like you're going nuts, which is not too smart in a world where fuel gets more expensive. It tends to mean that your machinery is more delicate because you had to shave away the weight to keep up the speed. If you look at the LCS with the semi-planing hull, I think it needs almost, it needs about 100,000 horsepower, which is kind of weird. And my understanding is that the speed was never really justified in any logical way. It was just sexy. It's not clear why you would want a small, tightly designed surface ship for that purpose. Because of the modules, the thing is essentially an aircraft carrier. Not carrying aircraft, but carrying these unmanned vehicles which screw these sensors. It's a very good idea. It's a very nice idea. All right, here's a question. Aircraft carriers pay off because you can mix and match the airplanes on board. They managed to make this thing fairly small, and it's not that small, by concentrating on only a single kind of module per ship. The only reason for that was they wanted an El Cheapo ship, and it's not so El Cheapo. So why is it such a hot idea? The reason that it's kind of mixed up is that it was done very, very fast because money for larger numbers of surface combatants was suddenly available after 9/11. And the Navy made a terrific case for having a lot more surface combatants so it could spread around its worldwide power. It was a very good case, by the way. I really liked it. The trouble is that that wasn't the case for these particular characteristics. It was a case for something that you could build in fairly large numbers. And the thing was essentially thrown together. People have kind of not noticed that. The world will indeed envy 45-knot ships for a while. They're very sexy. But we're supposed to be adults who think beyond that. And I don't think it's the next evolution of anything. I think it's about as hot as the PHM was. PHM is not even remembered anymore. It was a lovely hydrofoil with terrific technology. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. It was advertised as a terrific modular ship that would replace all big, fat, ugly, stupid surface combatants. And it's dead. It's so dead that we couldn't even unload it on anybody else. And I think this is the same story.
Given that strong feeling you have, Dr. Friedman, what should we be looking for a littoral work warship?
There isn't any such role. Period. If you want to operate in littoral, buy yourself a lot of these modules. Buy yourself something big enough to carry a fair number of them and sustain itself. By the way, these things are not self-sustaining in any sense. They're 21-day endurance. You notice that we haven't quite bought a lot of depot ships to support them in forward areas. And spend the money on the modules. That's the thing that's new. People act as though there's this fight for the littorals, whatever that's supposed to mean, in which dozens of enemy swarm boats come out and have to be fought back. Well, first of all, if you want to knock off swarming boats, if they're a serious threat, use helicopters with machine guns. They're real good at it. If you want to wipe out other people's missile attack boats, which, by the way, don't exist in such humongous numbers, again, are your own missiles fired from the air probably do the trick. Now, the other problem is mines, lots of them, and the modules and the unmanned vehicles look like they're a real good way of changing mine countermeasures. So what exactly is it that we're doing that involves this fight for littorals that you have to have a lot of small, hot-looking surface combatants for? I don't quite get it. But I just don't understand the beauty and newness of these sexy surface combatants.
I'll tell you what, Dr. Friedman, I have not been a fan of LCS since it first came out. I've been pinging on it for the blog since day one, back in 2004.
Well, clearly, I haven't convinced you to change your mind.
No, I'm still not a fan of LCS at all. And the one thing that was always brought up about it, that people would defend it about, was something you mentioned, the modules. But where we find ourselves in 2010 is the fact they're not even buying that many mission modules to begin with. And we've reached a point that they're not buying the mission modules, which had the one way that maybe LCS would prove me wrong. And what they're doing instead is you're also seeing people talking about how it's the replacement frigate. And I'm sure you've seen the AA module.
But it doesn't do those jobs. You can,
it doesn't
you can
at
modify
all.
It. There's talk about, well, you can put on a towed sonar. Yes, you certainly can. But you don't need 45 knots to make that worth the trouble. In fact, it's crazy to. You can use it for maritime interdiction, which may turn out to be an unbelievably important job. But you don't need very high speed. And if you have a fairly large ship with helicopters on board, it's probably a better bet. For anti-piracy, yes. If you could go 45 knots, you could almost go as fast as a cigarette boat. On the other hand, your helicopter can go a whole lot faster. Unless you sort of act as though the air no longer supports helicopters, having a ship which is very fast seems to be kind of stupid. The other thing is that it doesn't make it survivable because it can't outrun either a torpedo or a missile. So you have something which is fairly flimsy because you got to save weight to make speed, and it's operating in the most dangerous area, which is filled with torpedoes and mines and anti-ship missiles and everything else that bad people produce. It has very limited self-defense. Ram and that 57-millimeter gun are not an enormous thing. So why is this a terrific bargain?
And not to mention the fact that you're never going to use 45 knots when you're doing mine warfare. Galrin, did you have another question for Dr. Friedman?
Yeah, the Littoral Combat Ship was one of three elements that came from the sea portion of Sea Power 21. It was the DDG 1000 and then the cruiser. And both the DDG 1000 has been truncated. The cruiser's gone. Is this I guess we should call it the tragedy of the 21st century Navy, Sea Power 21, in hindsight? How do we look at Sea Power 21 now?
Sea Power 21, to me, was a discussion of basic principles. Most naval strategy documents try to explain to people who don't understand what navies can do what navies are about. That's a very valuable function, and because it seems so obvious, if you're involved with navies, people forget it. That's what matters. As far as the ships went, the reason that the DDG 1000 was a disaster was that the Navy got turned on by stealth, and the people who bought the destroyer didn't realize how impractical the level of stealth required really was. That has to do with a badly broken procurement system, which isn't even the Navy's fault. It comes out of a demand by the Office of Secretary of Defense in the 1990s that the Navy discard what until then had been a very effective procurement system. That's a tragedy, and it doesn't have to do with the Navy except that the Navy was a victim. DDG 1000 is a mess because it's so large for what you get, and it's so large because it'll sound funny because it's stealthy, because basically you have to cover everything with the right shape. And even with that degree of stealth, it probably won't work terribly well, but it'll be a terrific way of going bankrupt. As far as the cruiser goes, that's probably going to come back. The reason it's going to come back is that one of the things that we can very usefully offer other countries is to provide them with anti-missile defense without being on their soil. And I'll bet you that'll be a terrific demand. So something big with a very high-powered radar and a lot of anti-missile missiles will probably come back at some point. And, of course, if you take the Chinese carrier attack missile seriously, it's kind of useful for protecting the carrier. I hope it doesn't look like DDG 1000 because that's an abortion. But the tragedy was that the Navy sort of lost sight of what it really needed in favor of what looked sexy. And I'm not quite sure of how that happened, but you can only hope that it'll go away in favor of the more boring but rather good things we've had. I mean,
speaking of boring things we might need to have, what's your view on the sea base concept?
Well, again, if you start out with sea basing, all it says is that if we can dominate the area offshore, then we can use it effectively. And if you can avoid having a beachhead, which is what the Marines want very much to avoid, then it's much, much harder for someone to figure out where you're going to come ashore, and you can do a much better amphibious operation. Since no one has a lot of firepower anymore, it's very hard to go across a defended beach. The whole thing in amphibious operations is to avoid the defenses. You try to avoid defenses by making it hard for someone to guess where you'll come ashore. If you have to have a beachhead, you have to have a beach big enough to contain the stuff that you use to assemble for push inland. So a sea base gets attractive for that. A sea base also gets attractive if countries will accept our presence, but not with a whole lot of Americans ashore. For example, when we went into Afghanistan in 2001, we badly needed to be able to fly aircraft all the way up to that Marine base near Kandahar, which turned out to be kind of important. Pakistanis would allow us to fly over Pakistan, but a lot of Pakistani citizens were very, very unhappy with what we were doing. So the Pakistan government did not want a large American base built up inside Pakistan. This was really important. Well, we had the amphibs offshore. It turned out that the amphibs could land what was needed rather easily in small quantities, and then it became fairly easy to move it up to Kandahar. That made a tremendous difference. That was a sea base. No one called it that, but that's what it was. Now, if you set up a real sea base, there are all kinds of technical problems, but the real question about a sea base is how you defend it. And if the thing actually hangs around in one place, it becomes vulnerable to all sorts of attacks like ballistic missiles that people now have. Now, that also would be a reason for buying ships with serious anti-ballistic missile capability. How well that actually works out, it's a question of how well we can defend some area offshore or whether we can keep moving it around. And there are other technical issues. Talking about a specific program called the sea base may not be all that bright. Talking about using the sea and ships offshore as a dominant capability is a terrific idea. It's what the Navy's about. You see the difference?
Dr. Friedman, we're about 2 minutes left in the show, and just to wind things up here, your latest book is The British Destroyers from Earliest Days to the
Right.
Second World War. And as you're going through the research to develop that book and you're putting it together, was there something that you saw with how the British developed their destroyers up through 1939 that maybe clicked in your head and said, it's a lesson that we need to remember that we could take and think about as we look forward in the Navy that we need to focus with on our ships?
Actually, when you look at British development, the lesson is kind of that they messed up. I'm doing British cruises now, which are even more like this. The British got very good at designing ships very tightly, and they're elegant designs. Unfortunately for them, the world does not stay in one place. It keeps changing. When they hit World War II, a lot of new technologies suddenly became necessary, like radar, and they already had sonar, but a lot more depth charges and things like that. Oh, dear. All of a sudden, all those nice, elegant designs were too small. And in cruises, it's even more obvious. They kill themselves all through the interwar period to try to restrict the size of ships by treaty so they could afford enough. And that's the same kind of numbers versus size problem we have now, right? Well, they did a really good job. And then they found out that the ships they designed were a little too cleverly designed. They were too tight. And in particular, for one of these designs, if you look at their records, ever after, once the thing is being built, it's all, oh, my dear, what are we going to do, what are we going to do? Because every time they try to add the most trivial things, they're in trouble. The answer is, smaller is not a real good idea. Being smart about how to be tight is dumb.
One of the regular commenters on all of our blogs is a ship fitter, goes by Byron most of the time. And that's one of the things that he pings on a lot. When you get smaller, you got less to work with. and less to work with. Unfortunately, we have run out of seconds. Dr. Friedman, first of all, I want to thank you very much for coming on to Midrats and taking time this Sunday afternoon to do it. And I would really hope to have you back in the future, because speaking for Dalrin and Eagle One, sir, I think we could go on for hours on end. So thank you very much for your valuable time.
Thank you for having me. Right.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman.
Yeah, we need to have him back and talk about his network book. This, it's just a phenomenal book that I just finished reading before I started the Stores book. Well, Sal, it was a great, great episode. I'm glad that we were able to get Norman on.
Oh, I'm sorry I called so late. Thanks for having me.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.